Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. We've covered the conflict in Ukraine extensively over the last 14 months, and mostly from the perspective of holding the U.S. accountable for its role in provoking and prolonging it. The idea that Russia's invasion was provoked is controversial, and we must be careful to separate it from the question of whether the invasion was justified. Hardly anyone outside of Russia itself, it seems, feels that Putin had just cause to invade, and many in Russia are not supportive of the war as well. But other analysis, such as what we've been covering here, suggests that while unjustified, the invasion was predictable and therefore preventable, and is a consequence, at least in part, of the expansion of NATO, the military alliance to which the US and Canada and much of Europe, or Scandinavia, belongs. The eastward expansion of NATO, driven mostly by the U.S., has been advised against for decades by some in the U.S. intelligence community and warned against by Russia, which perceives it as a genuine threat. NATO membership means U.S. military bases and long-range missiles, or possibly even nuclear weapons, and it has long been the goal of the United States foreign policy to isolate and weaken Russia, just as it was to weaken and fracture the Soviet Union. The U.S. supported Osama bin Laden's Mujahideen in Afghanistan after a coup ousted that country's democratically elected administration and Islamic nationalists began vying for control. The Soviets invaded to restore the former administration, but the Islamists, funded and trained by the United States, waged a Vietnam-style guerrilla war and defeated the Soviet soldiers. The war was deeply unpopular in the Soviet Union, which was already weakened internally by decades of the Cold War. It eventually crumbled, and its former Soviet states, including Ukraine, were granted independence. The strategy with regard to Ukraine seems to again be to use the conflict to weaken Russia, even at the expense of Ukrainian lives, and in order to weaken Ukraine as well, making it dependent on Western investment, as we're seeing happen right now. At the same time, however, Russia has formed new alliances, both economic and political, with a variety of other nations, most importantly China, which has loaned a great deal of money to Russia. World power polarities were already in flux, with the U.S. losing its status as the world's single most influential superpower, but the conflict in Ukraine is serving as a catalyst to accelerate those shifts. In that regard, it appears to be backfiring on the U.S. and maybe on Russia, too. Professor John Mersheimer was an early critic of U.S. foreign policy in the region and is part of what has come to be known as the realism school of thought on international politics. Not much has changed since John Mersheimer began speaking out in opposition to the U.S. strategy of escalating the military conflict while suppressing efforts to seek a diplomatic solution. But as the conflict continues, the threat of nuclear war being used, or nuclear weapons being used, looms larger, especially as drone attacks within Russia, whether by Ukraine or by Russian nationalists opposed to Putin, become more frequent. Professor Mersheimer spoke last week at a salon organized by the nonprofit group Committee for the Republic.
What is the difference between the American Republic and the American Empire? The American Republic, as John Quincy Adams said, celebrates the March of the Mind. The American Empire celebrates the March of the foot soldier. The American Republic's birth certificate is the Constitution. The birth certificate of the American Empire is the strong do what they will and the weak accept what they must. The foreign policy of the Constitution is neutrality and influence abroad by example. Foreign policy of the American Empire is manifest destiny. The lifeblood of the American Republic is separation of powers. The lifeblood of the American Empire is limitless executive power. Ben Franklin advised at the Constitutional Convention that had given birth to a republic, not a monarchy, if we could keep it. Keeping it requires education. As Thomas Jefferson instructed, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, It expects what never was and never will be. James Madison echoed the same sentiment: knowledge will forever govern ignorance. If Americans voted out of office senators and representatives for violating their oath of office to defend the Constitution by unilateral surrender of the war power to the White House, chronic and pointless presidential wars would never have begun. Congress has declared war in but five conflicts over 234 years. We added it up the other day. It was 234 years. Clinton asked for war against Serbia in 1999. What did Congress do? Congress balked. Obama asked for war against Syria in 2013. What did Congress do? Congress balked. Congress has declared war in only in only cases of actual or perceived self-defense. So, that gets us to our speaker tonight. So let's imagine here for a moment that the American Republic is alive and well, and Congress did and is doing its job. What would we have? We'd have Fulbright hearings on Ukraine, and the star witness at those hearings would be our speaker tonight, Chicago professor John Mearsheimer. And John,
thank you very much, John, for the kind words. Thank you all for coming out tonight to listen to me speak. It's actually a pleasure to be here. There are three basic questions on the table about Ukraine. The first is, what caused the war? Number two is, what's the state of the war today? Where are we at the moment? And then the third question is, what is likely to happen moving forward? And I don't want to talk about the causes of the war. I may say a few words in the conclusion, but I'm not going to talk about the causes of the war. I want to focus mainly on where this train is headed. But to talk about where the train is headed, it's important to talk about where we are today first, and then segue in to talking about the future. And I'm going to make two arguments. The first argument is that there's no chance of a meaningful peace agreement. There may be at some point in the distant future a ceasefire, and that will then turn into a frozen conflict. But the chances of resolving this in any meaningful way are remarkably small, in my opinion. And then my second argument is that the Russians are going to win the war. They're not going to win a decisive victory, but they're going to end up conquering a huge chunk of Ukrainian territory beyond what they already have. And they're going to take Ukraine and make sure it remains a dysfunctional rump state. Let me make three preliminary points before I get to the substance of my talk. First of all, I'm predicting the future. And as we all know, we live in a remarkably uncertain world, and prediction is, you know, a tricky business at best. So just be aware that I'm not speaking the truth. I'm telling you what I think is likely to happen. Second point is, I am in the business of explanation. I'm not trying to justify the behavior of Putin or tell you what I hope happens. I'm simply going to tell you, based on a lot of experience thinking about these issues, what I think is going to happen. And then finally, you want to understand that I really need 4 hours, but John wouldn't give it to me. So I'm going to be certain. Quite cursory on a number of issues, and that'll leave plenty of opportunities for you folks to ask me questions, and I'll answer questions for as long as you want and John permits. Okay, so again, what I'm going to do is first focus on where we are today, right, and then I'm going to segue into talking about where this train is headed. With regard to where we are today, there are three main actors in the story. The United States or the West is one. Ukraine is two. And then on the other side, you have the Russians. And what we have to talk about is the threat environment that each one of those actors faces and the goals of each one of those actors as things stand today. In other words, we want to look at Russia, the West, and Ukraine. Focus on what the threat environment is, what their goals are. And then finally, we want to say some words about what the situation is on the battlefield today. And that's the basic outline I want to take you through in talking about the present situation. First of all, with regard to Russia's threat environment, there's no question that the Russians believe that they face an existential threat from the West and from Ukraine working together against them. An existential threat in the sense that they believe that their survival is at stake. And I can unpack later if people would like what is meant by the term survival. But there's no question that Putin himself uses the phrase existential threat to talk about what the Russians are facing. Now, there are two layers to that existential threat. The first layer is the pre-war layer, and that one is all about the West's efforts, and here the United States was really in the driver's seat, to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's border. And that strategy or policy, of course, included NATO expansion, EU expansion, and turning Ukraine into a pro-Western liberal democracy. Those three policies packaged together were all designed, again, to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's borders. The Russians made it unequivocally clear from 2008 forward that this was unacceptable and that it was not going to happen, and they made it clear that they would destroy Ukraine as a functioning society before they would let it happen. That's the first layer of the existential threat. The second layer of the existential threat comes into play after the war starts. Once the war starts, the United States has to stipulate what its goals are vis-a-vis Russia. And we have made it clear that our goal is to defeat the Russian military in Ukraine, to wreck its economy, and to, in effect, knock it out of the ranks of the great powers. There's also all sorts of rhetoric coming from the West and people in the administration, right, that make the argument that we should go beyond that and that we should pursue regime change. Then we should put Putin on trial. And there's even lots of talk these days about breaking apart Russia the way the Soviet Union broke apart in December 1991. This is the second layer of the existential threat. So there's no question that the Russians see themselves facing an existential threat. And I might add here that I have a number of friends who argue that the Russians are not facing an existential threat. My response to them is very simple. It doesn't matter whether you think they're facing an existential threat. The only thing that matters is whether they think they're facing an existential threat. And there the evidence is remarkably clear, in my opinion. So that's the threat environment for the Russians. Then the question is, what are their goals? Now, a lot of people think that the Russians are bent and have been bent since February 24th, 2022, in conquering all of Ukraine and in absorbing it into a greater Russia. The Russians have never been interested in that, and they're not going to try to do that. What the Russians are interested in doing is capturing a substantial portion of Ukraine and also making Ukraine a dysfunctional rump state. They have already formally annexed four oblasts plus the Crimea, and they have made it clear they have no intention of giving that territory up. I might add here that they don't control all four of those oblasts completely at this point in time. But those four oblasts plus Crimea make up 23% of Ukraine's territory. I also believe that they will take the four oblasts that are immediately to the west of those four oblasts, and this includes Odessa and Kharkiv. And once they do that, they will control 46% of Ukrainian territory. Dmitry Trenin, who is a well-known and well-plugged-in Russian strategist, argues that they will take those eight oblasts plus Crimea, as I described it, but they will also take additional territory in the north of Ukraine that runs basically up to the part of Kiev that is on the eastern bank of the Dnieper River. Now, what will guide Russia's thinking in the conquest of this territory? First of all, there's the Donbass problem. The Russians have to make sure that they basically take and control all of the areas that have large numbers of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. Because if they don't, they'll have the Donbass problem all over again. And you remember the Donbass problem from roughly 2014 to 2022, where you effectively had a civil war in that region between ethnic Ukrainians on one side and ethnic Russians and Russian speakers on the other. They don't want that to happen again. And the only way to prevent that from happening is to take all of the areas where you have large numbers of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. And that's why I think for sure they'll take those other four oblasts to the west of the four they've already taken. That's the Donbass problem. Then there's the Porcupine problem. The Porcupine problem is they don't want to conquer territory that has lots of ethnic Ukrainians because, as you all know, the ethnic Ukrainians hate them and they will fight like wild dogs to resist the Russians, even if the Russian military wins on the battlefield. So they will stay away from the territories in large part that are west of the Dnieper River. Then they have to make sure that they take enough Ukrainian territory that they turn Ukraine into a genuine dysfunctional rump state. For example, it makes eminently good sense, so lots of Russians say, to take Odessa, because if they control Odessa in addition to all of what they now control, they basically control Ukraine's Black Sea coastline, and that will enable them to strangle the Ukrainian economy whenever they see fit. So my argument is they're going to take a lot more territory than they already have taken, if they can. And you want to understand that I have not said anything about the military dimension of this conflict. And it may be the case that they don't have the military capability to take all that territory. We'll discuss that later. But now my point is that in terms of the goals that the Russians have set for themselves, I believe, based on a series of articles and conversations with some Russians, that their interest is in taking a large chunk of Ukrainian territory and also turning Ukraine into a dysfunctional rump state and keeping it as a dysfunctional rump state. Now, what about the United States and the West? And when you talk about the West, the main focus is on the United States because the United States is the leader of the pack. But nevertheless, the Europeans do matter somewhat. I don't want to completely dismiss their influence. Let's talk first about the threat environment, as I did with the Russians, and then go to the goals. It's very interesting. Before 2014, this is when the crisis first broke out, you all remember, in February 22nd, 2014. Before that date, even though we were interested in expanding NATO eastward, there's no evidence in the public record that that was aimed at containing Russia. There's no evidence that we thought Russia was a serious threat before February 22nd, 2014. But of course, when the crisis broke out, we did a sudden turn, and all of a sudden, Russia became a really serious threat. And you all understand that the reason we did that was we did not want to blame ourselves for the outbreak of the crisis. We wanted to blame the Russians. So, of course, Russia had to be a threat. Putin had to be an imperialist bent on creating a greater Russia. But that happened all of a sudden. But nevertheless, we did not view Russia as an existential threat at the time. I think since the war has started, we have slowly but steadily worked ourselves in the West to the point where we now view Russia as an existential threat. I'm not completely sure that's correct, right? But that's my sense, that that's where we're at. In the Russian case, it's easy to make the case that they see what we're doing in the West with Ukraine as an existential threat. And I'll get to Ukraine in a second. It's easy to make the case that Ukraine sees what the Russians are doing as an existential threat, obviously, right? With regard to the West and with regard to the United States in particular, it's a trickier case, so be aware of that. And we can go over that issue in the Q&A if need be. But why do I say that? Well, first of all, if you look at the East Europeans, and here we're talking mainly about the Poles and the Baltic states, they clearly view Russia as an existential threat. But I would argue that virtually every country in Europe depends for its security on NATO. This is not talked about much in the West. But the fact is that deep down, European leaders completely understand that NATO provides security for them. It's their security umbrella. And the great fear here is that if we lose in Ukraine, it will do significant damage, maybe even destroy the alliance. And therefore, people are deeply committed to making sure that that doesn't happen. And I sense that is, in effect, an existential threat. Then there's the United States and China. The fact is that the United States sees China as a greater threat than Russia. And in the United States, there's a widespread feeling that if we lose in Russia, that this will have a devastating effect on our ability to contain China. So we have to win. I think, in my opinion, there's no question that American policymakers view China as an existential threat. It's a peer competitor that's threatened to dominate Asia. We do not tolerate that. Russia's not a peer competitor, but if Russia wins in Europe and the United States is delivered a blow, it will have significant consequences for our position in Asia. Finally, I think there is a widespread perception that the Russians are a threat to the liberal international order. And even more importantly, this is a fight between democracies and authoritarian states. And if the Russians win, it'll be a devastating blow to the democracies in their competition with these authoritarian states. So you have somebody like King Charles who recently said in Germany, the security of Europe as well as our democratic values are at stake. The security of Europe as well as our democratic values are at stake. I think that view is widespread in Europe and even in the United States. And in fact, these are the words that were recently introduced in a congressional resolution that has not been passed yet. Quote, United States interests, European security, and the cause of international peace depend on Ukrainian victory. All of this to me hints that we view what the Russians are doing as an existential threat. Now, what are our basic goals? I've already explained what our basic goals are, right? We are bent on, again, knocking Russia out of the ranks of the great powers. We're even talking, again, about regime change in Russia, putting Putin on trial, and maybe breaking apart Russia the way the Soviet Union was broken apart in the early 1990s. So our goals are remarkably ambitious. And by the way, they're consistent with the claim that I made a minute ago that we view Russia as an existential threat. If you look at what we're doing, it fits neatly with the claim that Russia is an existential threat or something very close to that. Furthermore, it's very important to emphasize that we remain firmly committed to bringing Ukraine into NATO. And of course, this is an absolute no-no for the Russians. Let me say a few words about the Ukrainians now. Their threat environment. They view the Russians as an existential threat. This is really a no-brainer. Given what the Russians are doing in Ukraine, it's clear that Ukrainians think they are facing an existential threat. And with regard to Ukraine's goals are basically the same as our goals. The Ukrainians have a deep-seated interest in seeing Russia knocked out of the ranks of the great powers. To put it in General Austin's words, the Ukrainians have a deep-seated interest in making sure that Russia never again has the power to invade another country. So the Ukrainians are with us in terms of what the basic goals are. So I think basically what you have here is a situation where both Russia and Ukraine clearly view the other side as an existential threat, and where I believe the West, including the United States, view Russia as an existential threat. Now, let me say a few words about the battlefield. It's very important to understand that this is a war of attrition. The basic goal of each side is to bleed the other side white. This is not a war of maneuver. There are no blitzkriegs here. This is Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali standing toe-to-toe and beating the hell out of each other. This is a battle like World War I, fights at Verdun, at the Somme, and so forth and so on. It's a classic war of attrition. I think in 2002, for most of that year, I think the Ukrainians had the upper hand. And as you remember, in the late summer of 2022 and also in the early fall of 2022, Ukrainians scored victories in terms of capturing territory in Kharkiv and in Kherson. And as you know, the Ukrainians were at the end of last year, at the end of 2022, thought by many to be in a position where they could actually win the war, because 2022 was a good year. I believe that after the Russians mobilize 300,000 troops and begin to rationalize their military, make the necessary adjustments, I think what happened is that the Russians got the upper hand in 2023. And I think the Russians now have the upper hand. I think the fact that that the Russians just took Bakhmut, this fight that lasted for many months, and where the Ukrainians fought fiercely to contest the Russians. The fact that the Russians won, I think, is evidence that the Russians have the upper hand. I think the fact that the Ukrainians do not want to launch their counteroffensive is evidence that they're in trouble. The only reason they're thinking about launching an offensive and may indeed launch that offensive soon is because of tremendous pressure from the West. They don't want to do it because they understand that they're in trouble. And in a minute, I'll explain to you why that's the case. But despite the fact that I think the Russians have the wind at their back in 2023, in contrast to 2022, I don't think one could argue at this point in time the Russians have won the war in any meaningful way. So I just want to be clear, that's not my argument. I'm just making the case that today, when you look at the battlefield, you look at the military balance between the two sides, I think the Russians are in better shape than the Ukrainians. And I think, again, the Ukrainians were in better shape for most of 2022. All right. So let's shift gears now and talk about where we're headed. And let me focus first on the battlefield. And when I focus on the battlefield, I'll pick up from where I just left off, talking about the present situation on the battlefield. I'll talk about the future situation. And this is where I'll make the case that the Russians are going to win this war. This is, as I said, a war of attrition. It bears more resemblance to World War I than it does to World War II. And who wins a war of attrition is a function of three factors: the balance of resolve, the population size of the adversaries, and the amount of artillery that each side has. Very important to understand that artillery is the main weapon when you're fighting a war of attrition. When I was in the Army and then when I went to West Point, it was impressed upon us that artillery is the king of battle. And when you get into a fight like the Ukrainians and the Russians are now engaged in, the casualty exchange ratio is largely a function of the artillery on each side. So you want to ask yourself, as we think about this conflict, what does the balance of resolve look like? What do the population figures look like? And what does the balance of artillery look like? Because the balance of artillery tells you a great deal about casualty exchange ratios, which obviously matter greatly in a war like this. All right, start with resolve. In terms of resolve, I don't think there's any meaningful difference. Obviously, the Ukrainians are resolved to win this one and to get back their territory, completely understandable. And obviously, the Russians are resolved to win this one and settle this conflict as best they can on favorable terms. And given that they think they see an existential threat facing them, their resolve is great. So I don't see any meaningful difference in the balance of resolve. What about balance of population? Going into the war, the Ukrainians had far less people than the Russians. The balance was 3.5 to 1 going into the war. There were 3.5 Russians for every Ukrainian. Today, I believe there are 5 Russians for every 1 Ukrainian. You just want to think about that. 5 to 1 imbalance. You all understand that 8 million Ukrainians have left the country. 3 million have gone to Russia. And that 3.5 to 1 ratio that I gave you was based on the assumption that those Russian speakers and ethnic Russians in the Donbass counted as part of the Ukrainian population. They're now counted as part of the Russian population. I could go on and on about the numbers, but I think 5 to 1 is a good ratio to explain where we are at today. And this is bad news for the Ukrainians. Then we come to the artillery imbalance. Almost all of the reports on that balance say the number is either 5 to 1, 7 to 1, or maybe 10 to 1 in the Russians' favor. This has massive consequences. Massive consequences. You just want to think about what this war is all about. It's two armies standing toe-to-toe, trying to kill each other with massive amounts of firepower. And one side has a 5 to 1 or a 7 to 1 or a 10 to 1 advantage. side that's on the lower end of that ratio is in the deep kimchi. This is really horrendous. And by the way, that country that's on the downside of that ratio in artillery also is on the downside in the population ratio. What are the casualties look like on both sides? Very hard to get numbers. If you press me, I could give you an estimate, but it would just be suggestive on what the actual numbers are. But let's just talk about what the casualty exchange ratio is likely to be. The Ukrainians often say, and it's reported frequently in the West, that 7 Russians die for every 1 Ukrainian. This is ludicrous. 7 Russians die for every 1 Ukrainian, given that artillery imbalance? This fails the common sense test. I think that the exchange ratio is more like 2-1. I think that 2 Ukrainians probably die for every 1 Russian. I have a number of friends who believe the number is higher. It's more like 3-1, maybe even 4-1. Again, just given those artillery figures, it's got to be 2-1 at least. So the Ukrainians are losing lots more people than the Russians are. Now, let me argue against myself, okay? One could say John's wrong, because what John is ignoring is that the Russians are on the offensive. As you all know, the Russians are the aggressor here. There's no question about that. It was Putin and company who invaded Ukraine. They are the aggressor. They are on the offensive. And as you know, offenders usually suffer 3 casualties for every 1 casualty that the defender suffers. This is the famous 3-1 rule of thumb. You need 3 attackers. You actually need more than 3 attackers, right, to overcome 1 defender on the battlefield, because the offender is out in the open and is exposed to fire, whereas the defender is down in a foxhole or down in a trench and is protected somewhat. Okay? So the argument against me is that because the Russians are the aggressor or the offender, they should be suffering 3 casualties for every 1 that the Ukrainians suffer. There's 3 problems with this argument. The first is that the Ukrainians have been on the offense almost as much as the Russians have been. As I said to you before, 2022 was a very good year for the Ukrainians because they launched offensives in Kharkiv and Kherson. And they were launching other offensives of a smaller nature in other places. People were talking about the Ukrainians' ability to engage in maneuver warfare. Okay? So if you look at the course of the war since February 24th, 2022, it's very difficult to make the argument that the Russians have been on the offensive more than the Ukrainians have been on the offensive. It looks like a wash to me. Another problem with this is if you look at the actual battles, places like Bakhmut, sort of other places where the Russians and the Ukrainians have really duked it out, what you discover is that the defender often counterattacks. And what that means is that the defender goes on the offense. So I spent a lot of time way back when studying Civil War battles and studying World War I battles. If you look at those battles and you look at who is the attacker and who is the defender, in some cases, this is true of Verdun. The offender actually suffers less casualties than the defender, right? And that's because the defender goes on the offense for defensive purposes, and the offender becomes the defender, and then the offender goes back on the offense, right? So you have this back and forth. Look at Civil War battles. You look at the 12 biggest Civil War battles. The casualty exchange ratios regardless of who initiated the campaign, are basically one-to-one in a good number of those cases. It's really quite interesting. So it's very hard to say that in the battles that have been fought in Ukraine, that the Russians have been the attackers. And they, therefore, have suffered much greater casualties. Because even if they were initially the attackers, they morphed into defenders at different points, then went back to being offenders, and the same basic process was taking place on the Ukrainian side. And the end result is it's a wash. Third argument you want to keep in mind is that in the Western media, you see constant references to the Russians launching mindless frontal assaults or frontal attacks. Think of World War I, everybody getting up out of the trenches, charging across an open field and getting mowed down. And this is the picture that the media wants to give you of what the Ukrainians are facing when the Russians come at them. And of course, they're just mowing them down. And this is why there are 7 Russians dying for every 1 Ukrainian. This is a myth. It's just simply not true, right? This is not to say the Russians haven't launched a few frontal attacks here and there. It's very clear from the news reports that the Russians have become much more sophisticated, and they're using their infantry in small packets to basically smoke out, figure out where Ukrainian forces are, and then pouring huge amounts of artillery on those forces. They're not engaging in frontal assaults. And amazingly, 10 minutes before I came down, I was looking at my iPhone, and the latest issue of The Economist came across. And this is one of the lead stories. Russia's tactics are improving, but Ukraine can still win. Russia's tactics are improving, but Ukraine can still win. See? What's happened here is that The Economist has got hold of a new report that's come out from the Royal United Services Institute in Britain, which I would suggest you all take a look at. It makes it very clear that the Russians are employing smart tactics. They're not employing frontal wave tactics. So the end result of this is that large numbers of Russians are not dying, right? There's no question Russians are dying. They're not dying in anywhere near as large a number as the Ukrainians are. So I think 2-to-1 is a reasonable estimate, a casualty exchange ratio of 2-to-1. And I think when you marry that to the population size of Ukraine and the population size of Russia today, you can see what's going on in Ukraine. What exactly do I mean by that? It's quite clear that Ukraine is engaged, from their point of view, in a total war. They have mobilized their entire society. They have soldiers who are as old as all of us out there fighting. They have old dogs and young dogs, lots of untrained people. It's because they're desperate. And they're also dragging people off the street, right? There are all sorts of stories about how they're out searching for young people who they can commandeer and put in the military. This is not the case with the Russians, right? In fact, lots of people, me included, wonder why the Russians haven't really mobilized their society in a larger way, right? And by the way, this big fight that just took place in Bakhmut, it's clear that the Ukrainians pushed large numbers of their best troops into Bakhmut to try and hold Bakhmut. It was not the Russian army, however, that was doing most of the fighting in Bakhmut. It was the Wagner Group. There's this huge Russian army out there. Remember those 300,000 people they mobilized? And those people were mobilized on top of a foundation of soldiers that already were there. They have a lot of people. They have a lot of people in their military. But their mainline forces have not been fighting. The Ukrainian forces have been fighting the mainline forces. They tried like crazy to hang on to Bakhmut, and they couldn't do it, but it was with mainline forces. All right. All of this tells you why I think they're going to win. Now, let me conclude by talking about the possibility of peace agreement. Not going to be a peace agreement, meaningful peace agreement. Not going to happen. You'll get a frozen conflict. Why is there not going to be a meaningful peace agreement? Two main reasons. The first is the territory problem. The Ukrainians want their territory back. The Russians have made it clear they're not going to get their territory back. The Russians are not going to give up those four oblasts they annexed. They're not going to give up Crimea. And the Ukrainians insist on getting that back. Zelensky told Xi exactly this. There'll be no peace agreement until we get all our territory back. And the Russians are going to end up taking more territory. And they're not going to give that back either. How do you square that circle? Second big problem is the neutrality problem. The Russians insist that Ukraine be neutral. Right? They've insisted this from the beginning. And their argument is if Ukraine can't be neutral, they're going to wreck it. They're going to wreck it to keep it out of NATO. Or if it's in NATO, it'll be ineffective because it's wrecked. Right? The Ukrainians, on the other hand, they don't want neutrality. The Ukrainians, for completely understandable reasons, want a security guarantee from someone. Well, there's the question of who is that someone? The only someone out there is the United States or the West or NATO. And that's not going to happen, right? That's not going to happen in ways that will please the Russians. The Russians will not accept that. So how do you square that circle? No. Two other quick problems here. One is the hyper-nationalism problem. There's a lot of nationalism in the air before this war started. It's morphed into hyper-nationalism, which means the hatred on both sides is off the charts. It's going to make a peace agreement very difficult. And then the other problem is that a number of leaders have made it clear that they lied to Putin about their commitment to the Minsk agreement. You remember the Minsk agreement, which was formulated in late 2015, was designed to shut down the conflict in the Donbass. And Putin was deeply committed to making the Minsk agreement work because he did not want to invade Ukraine. Angela Merkel, Francois Hollande, Petro Poroshenko, and Zelensky himself have all said they never had any interest in making Minsk work, and all they were doing was buying time to build up Ukraine so it would be in a better position to fight Russia. Trust? There's no trust on the Russian side because of this. So you see, you have a problem involving territory, a problem involving neutrality, hyper-nationalism, and zero trust. You're not going to get a meeting peace agreement, you're going to get a frozen conflict. Let me conclude by just very briefly saying that what's remarkable about this case is that there were a significant number of people in the United States who argued that expanding NATO was going to lead to disaster. It included people like George Kennan. It included people like the actual Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, and the actual chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Clinton administration, saying this was a disaster in the making. It included people like Paul Nitzer and Jack Matlock, of course. There were a panoply of impressive intellects who said that this was a prescription for disaster. And you know what? They were right. And the end result is we are in this situation where enormous damage has already been done to Ukraine, most importantly, but to the West, to Russia, and to the United States. And with the passage of time, I'm sad to say, it's only going to get worse. Thank you.
put the online people up? Thank you, John. That was great. We have a significant amount of people that could not be here physically who want to participate. Okay. I see Ray McGovern there. Ray, I see you there. And Ray, Ray, you want to ask the question about options, right? Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. Can you hear me all right?
Clearly.
Am I? All right, good. Hi, John.
Hello, Ray.
Hello, John. Two questions, really. The first one is just a small question, and that is, you don't get to Washington, D.C. very much. Have people in the State Department and the CIA and the Pentagon be after you to consult with you, given your expertise on this, or have you not heard anything from them this time?
I am 75 years old. I have been in this business for a long time. I have never once in my entire career been asked by a government official, Republican or Democrat, for my opinion on anything.
Okay. Okay. Second question. There's the conventional wisdom that Vladimir Putin had other options to invading Ukraine. This is sort of accepted widely by virtually everyone. No one can tell me what those options are. Do you know what they might be talking about, John? End of question.
No, I don't think he had any other options. I do believe that Putin was deeply committed to finding a negotiated settlement to the problem. As I said to you in my formal comments, he was deeply committed to the Minsk Agreement because what he wanted to do was shut down the conflict in the Donbass so he would not have to invade. And with regard to NATO expansion, EU expansion, and the efforts to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's borders, he went to great lengths to explain to the West why that was unacceptable. And on December 17th, 2022, he sent the letter to Putin. Putin sent a letter to Biden and to NATO saying that you have to do X, Y, and Z so we can find a solution to this problem. And we refused to go along. And I think that Putin was left in a position where he felt he had no choice. Because to answer your question, there was no other way to deal with the problem. So I think he, with great reluctance, invaded Ukraine.
Why did Finland and Sweden enter NATO, join NATO, if they didn't fear Russia? So if you could address NATO expansion.
I think that there's no question that the Finns and the Norwegians fear Russia. I mean, given the level of Russophobia in the West, and given all the talk since 2014, and certainly since February 2022 about the Russian threat, it would make perfect sense for lots of Finns to fear the Russians. Do I believe that they should have feared the Russians? No. They survived the Cold War perfectly well when the Soviet Union was a heck of a lot more of a formidable adversary than Russia is. And furthermore, as I've emphasized time after time, there is zero evidence that Putin ever said he was interested in conquering and absorbing Ukraine into a greater Russia. Much less that he was interested in conquering any other countries. He just never said that. The idea that he was going to conquer Finland or take some Finnish territory or Swedish territory is not a serious argument to me. But my opinion is that serious arguments don't carry the day.
in the world that we now live in. And, you know, the Finns and the Swedes obviously thought there was a serious threat here. And what they think does matter, as I said before. And this was a good opportunity to sneak into NATO because the Russians were obviously in no position to do anything about it because they're pinned down in Ukraine. But I would just end by saying that anybody who thinks this is all for the good is thinking wrongly. This is not good. It's just going to give the Russians an increased sense of vulnerability, an increased sense that they're being surrounded, and it's going to scare the Russians, and it's going to make them take greater risks. I've spent my life studying great power politics, and one thing you never want to underestimate is when you corner a great power and you threaten the great power, excuse me, you do not want to underestimate the risk that it might be willing to take. And the Russians are in that category for sure. And by the way, we all know about the Arctic, and we know that there are eight countries that are located in the Arctic. One is Russia. The other seven now are all NATO countries. The other seven are all NATO countries, and Russia's up there. And you know what's happening to the ice up in that neck of the woods, right? The ice is melting, and you know that has all sorts of consequences of an economic and strategic nature. So there's going to be security competition up there. You think it's good that the Finns and the Swedes are with those other NATO countries against Russia? I don't think so. I think it's just more evidence of the trouble that lies ahead.
That was Professor John Mersheimer, who teaches at the University of Chicago, speaking about the current war in Ukraine. Next week, I hope to cover some of the issues at stake in the competing budget proposals that are at an impasse and which threaten to force the U.S. to default on its national debt, whether that actually happens or is resolved in time for next week's show, which, as always, will air here on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, with its 98.3 FM broadcast expected to resume here in about a week, and on WGRNLP, which will resume its broadcast on the airwaves on its new frequency of 91.9 in about a month. Both stations need your financial help to cover the cost of facility moves and upgrades. Please give what you can at WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week. Oh, by the way, we need volunteers for both stations at the Community Festival, the last full weekend in June here in Goodale Park, especially for security volunteers, but there are plenty of volunteer shifts in all aspects of the festival. Go to comfest.org, or comfest.com, rather, and there's a sign-up process there to volunteer at the festival. It's fun. You get a T-shirt, possibly even a token for beer or food, and the credits also go to the nonprofit organization of your choice, WCRS-FM, WGRN-FM. We really could use the points. We'll hope to have an information booth there as well this year. So I'll see you there and also here next week. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented.